Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezi Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Well, today is Friday. It's January 25, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Got a very exciting story, a compelling story to tell you about today with our first guest, Ossining Mayor Victoria Garrity. Well, she'll be on very shortly. We're going to open the broadcast with her this morning, sharing a fascinating connection that Ossining has with the old world, that is, Ireland, Limerick to be exact. And she shares the visit of the Honorable former Mayor of Limerick, his name is Joe Harrington, and his family. They were involved in the restoration of the Glen House School in Lyre Acrompain. I hope I'm not butchering the name, I probably am. It seems they discovered a connection between the historic schoolhouse and Sing Sing Correctional Facility. So representatives of Sing Sing Correctional Facility and the Sing Sing Prison Museum Board and the Ossining Town Supervisor, Dana Levenberg, joined Mayor Garrity to celebrate the findings. So we're going to find out what those findings were. It certainly has drawn two communities from across the seas together again, which is going to be very fascinating. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I'm doing well, Hezi. How are you doing today?
I'm so excited about this compelling story between Ossining and Ireland. I know I butchered the name, this small little town called, had it written down? Yeah, Lyre Acrompain. Is that how you pronounce it?
You know, I regret that I didn't write down a pronunciation key for myself when Joe Harrington told me what it was. Good enough. My
okay,
Irish
well, hopefully it's
is good no
enough. But the connection is between the Glen House School in that village and Sing Sing Prison. Now, what is that compelling
right.
story? It sounds almost like a love rekindled.
Yes, well, you know, Joe Harrington, who was the former mayor of the city of Limerick, and he now lives in that village that you and I are going to struggle to pronounce, where the schoolhouse is that they're looking to restore and turn into a local museum. But he happened to be in Ossining this weekend because his son, who moved to New York City a number of years ago, got married last weekend. So the family
okay.
came over from Ireland and for a family occasion, but since he was coming to America, he decided he would look into some of the potential connections between us because he had learned that John Sheehy, who attended this Glen Schoolhouse, what's the full name? I'm not reading, I'm driving, so I'm not looking at the name of the schoolhouse.
No, it's called Glen House School.
The Glen House School. Okay. Someone who had been a student there many, many years ago had then emigrated to the United States and had worked at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. I believe he was the right hand to the warden there for a number of years, and he is now buried in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. So when the Mayor Harrington was looking into the connections with Sing Sing, he said, I'd love to take a picture with the current mayor of Ossining. So we said, well, this is a good photo op, and we got a whole bunch of us who are interested in history, interested in Sing Sing, and also involved in the Sing Sing Prison Museum. So the photo that you saw that I circulated around was a number of us who were involved in the Sing Sing Prison Museum. We got together, including
right.
Arthur Wolpinski. Arthur Wolpinski is the historian for the Sing Sing Prison, and he was really instrumental in giving us a little background and bringing us all together for the event. So it was a lovely way to spend a dreary Sunday morning. We got a break in the rain to be able to take some nice pictures right in front of Sing Sing Prison. That's where the photo you saw. We were standing on the steps there as you enter the prison, and got to learn more about what their plan is. And we're on these somewhat parallel paths, having you know, the Sing Sing Prison Museum is in the stage of continuing to get more fundraising, but we now have a plan to move forward with restoring the old powerhouse, which is on the Sing Sing grounds. And the next step will be, and actually we're already working on the restoration to of the original 1825 cell block. And that is, of course, the intention is with it, I believe, I don't want to say the year. I believe it's 2025. We hope to open the doors for the Sing Sing Prison Museum. And meanwhile, our friends back over in the old country in Ireland are working on their Glenhouse School and restoring that as their local historic landmark. And so sharing the tying the two stories together was a really nice connection to make.
Well, it seems like, you know, it really is almost shocking because who would have thought that Sing Sing Prison would become something that you brought up from the ashes and resuscitated somehow, and it's become part of that concept of adaptive reuse, I guess. I don't know. How did that even originate, that whole prospect for turning Sing Sing Prison into something that's becoming an attraction?
Yeah, it's a very tricky relationship, and it's something that's been suggested a number of times over the years because obviously there's 1,800 people who live at Sing Sing Correctional Facility,
right.
They wish that they didn't. And the pieces of the property that could become the museum are an old powerhouse that was really only in use for a relatively short period of time in the history of the prison, but then connected with a corridor through the security wall into the original cell block that was built by inmates who were brought down from Auburn Prison in 1825 to quarry the Sing Sing marble and build their own building in time to keep themselves warm in the winter. And that was the original cell block. It was the largest prison cell block in the country, and still is. It's the size of, I believe, 3 football fields. It's enormous, and it is.
Wow.
It does not have a roof, but the walls of it are remarkably well structurally sound. That was one of the first things to figure out, was to have the architectural engineers, historic specialty, to come in and determine the stability of the structure. And we were really pleased to find out that it's stable. So then what kind of a museum would possibly make sense to invite tourists into the property that is part of our correctional system in our country, which is clearly a deeply flawed system, regardless of some of the really lovely, wonderful, successful rehabilitation programs that are taking place at Sing Sing Prison, that does not in any way balance out the challenges we have in the criminal justice system, particularly when it comes to institutional racism and the major challenges we have in social justice that leads to the prison system that we have today.
But that's just but that's not only there, it's across the nation.
Of course. But most prisons don't invite you in with your families for a Sunday afternoon cultural experience. So figuring out how to balance, how to be not only sensitive, but to really honor the challenges that have brought people there and everyone, the folks who are incarcerated, the formerly incarcerated people, their families, the victims, and their families, and the people who work in the prison system. And so identifying all of the people who are involved in let's just talk about Sing Sing, is one of the four, pillars of the mission for the Sing Sing Prison Museum. But the other one that really is what's most motivational to those of us who are working to see this happen for Ossining is for the museum to be a center for justice, to challenge people who are museum goers just for a day, or people who come to the museum to learn and to think with other folks about how the criminal justice system works and how it needs to be better, and that is really a core component of the Sing Sing Prison Museum project. And I actually, the first one is to be the best prison museum in the country. and what I've always said is, when people push back and are concerned about it being insensitive, which is a very reasonable response to have, that I want people to be able to say to people, you just have to come. It's such a powerful experience, and it will help you see things in a new way. And it's going to do that, and it's very exciting to be part of this process as it gets off the ground.
So you mean to tell me you're thinking of creating, introspection into the whole legal and incarceration system that's presently here? And then there are a lot of people who may be imprisoned but are actually innocent. And so is that part of something maybe connecting with the innocence projects that are out there?
No doubt that it is likely to be one of the topics that is incorporated into the education and the I don't know if it's appropriate to call it a think tank, but if the goal is to be a center for justice, then we need to bring together people who are working to improve the criminal justice system from all aspects. So that makes perfect sense that would be aligned with the mission.
So in a sense, because I know that Osning was definitely, Osning, the prison, had a big impact on the city, but that somehow didn't seem to, thwart the capacity of the town and the city and the village to move forward. So it didn't drag, Osning into a state of decay or anything like that. How did you eclipse that? Because you would think that would be a negative connotation about the Osning, but it really hasn't, has it?
I suppose it depends on what era and who you talk to. It's certainly part of our identity. The birth of the village and the birth of the prison are inextricably linked. The village was incorporated in 1813, and the original cell block that we were just referencing was built in 1825. So we've really grown up together. It's the largest employer in the village of Osning, and yet the majority of people who live in our community have never been inside the walls of the prison. Yeah. And on a day-to-day basis may not particularly think about it, depending on what neighborhood you're in. Some neighborhoods you can hear folks out in the yard play basketball. It doesn't cast a dark shadow. There are certainly people in our community who work in the prison. It does provide some local jobs, but not to the same degree that you see in some upstate communities where the prison is the primary source of jobs for people. We certainly have much more diversity of job opportunities in Osning, and particularly just because we're part of the densely populated river towns of Westchester County. Osning is also probably, Sing Sing is probably the most famous prison in the country, with the possible exception of Alcatraz. But as far as active prisons that still have folks living in it and are operating it, and for the foreseeable future will continue to be, that's another topic that comes up periodically is, why don't we just close down Sing Sing Prison? It's beautiful real estate. It's right on the Hudson River. There's no place more valuable in the region to purchase property and want to, develop some luxury high-rises. That is clearly not in the plan for New York State, and also not something that I would advocate for. It's the people who live in the or are incarcerated at Sing Sing Prison more often than not come from New York City. And if they're in an easy Metro North train ride from the city, they have much greater chance of maintaining family connections, which are going to be essential when they're released. And almost all of them are released. And so, what we want to do is help people to be reformed, to have the best shot possible at not coming back. So I've never been a proponent for closing down the prison. Before I was mayor and while I'm mayor, I see it as more of a moral issue for incarcerated people to not be taken any further away than necessary from their hometowns. We're not locking them away forever.
I've known I've known people that are imprisoned up in Connecticut or out in Pennsylvania in the boondocks. it seems, and it's very difficult for their family to somehow travel there. Really, it's very, very far. You know, I've never been to any of those places, and I don't know anybody who's been imprisoned there, but I know of people, and it's very, very difficult on the family, for sure. And I'm sure on the prisoners.
Well, of course.
When you think about the past in one way, and then you're thinking into the future, you seem to have moved very far ahead into planning for a future, and you're undertaking so much with respect to Austin itself and deciding what to build and where to build and how to develop. And is that impacting the image of Austin as well?
Well, we've had a lot of positive things happening. You know, I'm actually driving back to Austin right now from having attended an Arts Westchester event. There were a number of Arts Alive grants that were awarded this morning to arts programs all over Westchester County, and even some in Rockland. And I was, it always heartens me, not just because I'm mayor, but because it's my home, when Austin gets special recognition. And we had a number of the grantees, both from the library, the Austin Arts, Austin Documentary Discussion Series was a recipient, so I was there wearing two hats, both as a proud mayor and a grateful applicant. The Austin Public Library has a number of programs that were received grants. There was an individual artist, Lindsay Francis, who lives in Austin and is doing some particular art classes that she's teaching that were received funding from this, and the Westchester Collaborative Theater, who, of course, owns their own Black Box Theater in downtown and produces all original art, original plays. And so when we were up on the stage, the head of the Arts Westchester program gave a real shout out to Austin and was just touting us as this community that is more and more on the art scene, and they were so pleased to be part of that. And that's emblematic of what we're seeing for entrepreneurial businesses as well. We've got some new entrepreneurial businesses that are just thriving in Austin. So, yeah, and people are taking notice, and I'm very pleased about that. But really, the big picture, what we need to be focusing on for going forward is every community has a comprehensive plan, and that's the foundation for all of our zoning laws. And the zoning laws are what dictate what kind of development can be in what kind of neighborhood. Is it a single family district? Is it a multifamily district? Is it a commercial district? Can there be a mixed-use district? And how high do we want our buildings to go? And then how dense do we want a neighborhood to be? And all of those decisions are born out of our comprehensive plan. And we are just now embarking on updating our comprehensive plan because it's 10 years old, which – if you talk to folks in other municipalities, and I know you do, the next time you're talking to representatives of other municipalities, ask them how old their comprehensive plan is. Some of them will say 50 years old, or they won't even know.
Yeah.
And clearly, something 50 years old is not at all. Yeah. And how can that possibly reflect the character and the values of your community today? And so we're just 10 – ours was over 40 years old when we redid it 10 years ago. But it really should be reviewed every 10 years. We've been living with it for a decade. Our demographics have changed a little bit, and we've lived with the existing comp plan with only some minor tweaks here and there. And now it's time to do a real update. And so the best way to do that is to ask the community to help us envision who – do you believe Austin is, and who do you believe Austin will grow to become in the next 10 or 20 years, and then figuring out how to become that vision of the best Austin we can imagine.
Well, that's an exciting project. Very, very exciting. And probably does engage everybody in Austin, don't you think? Because you seem to have a lot of people there that get engaged.
Well, we do. We have a highly engaged community, and yet we still need to work harder on engaging across every neighborhood, every demographic, every age group, every cultural group, every income level, because as you've seen that I've spoken about a lot since my inauguration, the folks who tend to raise their hand and volunteer for things, the folks who tend to email me and come by for office hours, tend to be older, wealthier, and whiter than the community overall. And we want everybody to be involved, and we want everyone to know that not only are they welcome at the table, they are essential at the table for us to really be able to make a comprehensive plan that reflects the experience of everyone in our community. We need to have everyone participating, whether they are serving on the Comprehensive Plan Committee, and it's important that we have an incredible wealth of diversity on the Comprehensive Plan Committee, or they are participating in community meetings and community surveys, and that's what we're going to be doing for the next year. But it kickstarts, I'm glad you gave me this intro, we're having at least one, maybe two meetings on February 28th at the Ossining Public Library to help people understand exactly what the Comprehensive Plan Committee will be tasked with, and hopefully get some a nice broad participation in that. And that presentation that we do at the library, we're also going to be sharing in other venues, and that messaging is already being shared and being pushed out to the press in a variety of ways. So we're always trying to ratchet up our ability to connect with people and to connect with more people. Ossining is as diverse as any city in the world, and more than most. And our decision-making needs to be reflective of that.
Yeah, I've got that impression about Ossining as well. So I guess that's part of what you guys are doing there, so which is great, the citizenry and government.
Yeah.
And it's very compelling. You could see it. You can feel it. You have to be deaf and blind and insensitive somehow not to recognize it. Is that part of the strut of Ossining? It seems like it's got a very, very powerful gait somehow. Not everybody can claim that.
Well, maybe we do a better job at just not pretending to be something that we aren't. And if you're more authentic, then you can walk with a little more confidence. Perhaps that's true.
Yeah, that might be it. That's very well put. So what are your future plans? Anything in particular? Are you growing the arts venue in Ossining?
We do. In fact, this is the time of year where we renew cabaret licenses. And we just did three more this week, and there's more venues that are opening up. I made mention of the Westchester Collaborative Theater, which they do original plays, and they also host musical events, jazz nights, and things of that sort. But in recent years, there's been jazz that started up on at the Elks Club, at the Elks Lodge, which is much more than the Elks Lodge these days. They have a lot of jazz performances. And the Ossining Arts Council, which is a nonprofit organization that makes use of an upstairs room in one of our firehouses in downtown. And it's a room that the fire company that owns the building was not using. And they do art exhibits, and they do performances. And those have opened up over the years. And then the more recent one that's really filling their calendar now, I have a personal connection to, is the Sing Sing Prison. the Sing Sing Kill Brewery, and my husband and his partners own it, and they've just filled their calendar for the next couple of months with a variety of musical events, and they have a really exciting art show that they are partnering with the Bethany Arts Community, which is just down the road from some of these other venues I was talking about, on the edge of just outside the edge of the village. It's the old Mary Knoll Missionaries property that's been transformed to some studio space and exhibit space and performance space and artists in residence. And they're collaborating, the Sing Sing Kill Brewery and the Bethany Arts Community, with a local artist named R. Wayne Reynolds. And he, my husband Eric, his day job is working as a grip in the film industry. So rigging is a big part of his job. And he has rigged it's sort of like a sling for the artist to hang from and create these giant works of art. And he's directed by a patron who pays to create some art, and they pull him along a pulley system to create these single line drawings. It's so much more. It's a fascinating experience. It's really a way to get people involved in arts, and that's happening in February and March. It kicks off with a reception at the brewery for R. Wayne Reynolds, and he's got art that is, I guess it's not infinite, but there are, the art is in pieces, and you are invited, everyone, children, family members, anybody can come and is invited to create their own art with these pieces. because they can all fit in a variety of ways. And so there's thousands, I think, of variations of what the art can actually look like. And the overall goal is to make art accessible to everyone and stop being some erudite, elitist, venue or medium for people, and get people to really engage with the art, with the artist. So, I think it's just reflective of who we are as a community, who Ossining is as a community, and have taking art from some ivory tower and putting it into a bar or into a community arts. An arts community is really reflective of who Ossining is, where we really want people to get out of their homes to walk. We're trying to be a much more walkable community because we are so densely populated, and so many people can walk from their homes to the downtown or to one of these venues and really engage with their neighbors and engage with creative ways to connect.
Well, you know, while you're talking, I was just realizing, of all things yesterday, I happened to hear from an author who advised me that her project that she was hoping that would be picked up by Lifetime, as a TV station, they were going to do a movie about a book that she wrote. But unfortunately, it failed. And I was thinking, as you were talking, like so much of what comes on stage actually is derived from from movies. Not everything, but a lot. And sometimes it works the other way, where there's a film made of a Broadway show. And maybe I should just simply ask her to give you a call if that's okay with you. And she may have I haven't even talked to her about this, but I think that would be terrific to do it with some of your theater groups there.
Oh, if she's not familiar with the Westchester Collaborative Theater, she would love it. She should learn about it. It's a wonderful place for particularly for writers to workshop their projects. And I imagine if she's come this far in some of her writing that she has some others as well. And they do readings.
Does.
Performances. It's a wonderful collection. It's a lot of people from Ossining, but I don't think most of the members are necessarily from Ossining. But Ossining is their the host community, and we draw locally. But it's called the Westchester Collaborative Theater because it truly is welcoming to people from around the area. And it's a sometimes
so she's
the people
definitely
who
from
are
Westchester.
Both, yeah, good. Well, it could be a full-time writer, but sometimes it's somebody who's an attorney that always enjoyed writing and wanted to reinvigorate their mind and has done some creative things, or who are people who are looking for a change in their career. Connect her to the Westchester Collaborative Theater, or just send her to me and I'll connect her with them, please.
Okay, that sounds really great. Well, as usual, you've stumped anybody who thinks that you're not the best. So it's really, really cool. I appreciate you making the time on Friday, no less. And all the best to you. Have a great week. And then we're going to be speaking on Monday, aren't we?
Yes, that's right. We're going to be speaking on Monday with one of our panelists from the film that we're showing next week, which was it next? No, actually, it's a week from Monday. We're speaking on February 4th, and then the screening is February 7th.
So we're not going to speak on Monday. Okay.
Not this Monday, but it won't be too long. Just 10 days from now, we'll be back on air together, Hezzy. And the film is written by. The film is actually written by James Baldwin, and it's called I Am Not Your Negro. Yes, he's credited as the writer. Obviously, there's been a lot of editing since then, but he is very much in the film, and it's a very, very powerful film. So I look forward to talking about that with you on February 4th.
Yeah, that is really a compelling movie. In fact, it was interesting because I just noticed it about a week or two ago. In a streaming TV program that I subscribe to, so it was there, and I didn't have the time to look at it, but I'll try to do it over the weekend, this weekend, to see it.
Please do.
So that'll be very nice.
Or you can just join us on February 7th.
You know, I'm trying to get my act together. Right now I'm just so involved in so many things. I'm still going to the doctor. And
I'm
don't
sorry.
Know if you heard, but there's a lawsuit filed against us, you know, which is really exciting. But that's how it works.
Most
you know,
don't have
when you do the news.
Okay.
Well, anyway, so that's the story, and I've got to go see the lawyer today. So all the
Good
best.
Luck, Hesley.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. All righty.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. How exciting. It doesn't get more compelling than that. It's always great to speak to Ossining Mayor Victoria Garrity. And what a great story about connection between Limerick and this place called Lyra Crompane and the schoolhouse there, the Glen House School, and the Ossining Prison. Very, very compelling. It's amazing. Well, I guess so many people have been in Ossining incarcerated there that there's probably a connection from all over the world somehow. And evidently this is indicative of it. Well, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll move on. Let's first find out what they're doing at the Yonkers Tribune, and we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. If you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, then, of course, it is possible to reach them at 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. You could text them. You could call them. It's also the office number. It's all of that tied into one. Well, there is some important news that came out, of course. Roger Stone, a Trump ally, has been arrested on 7 Mueller probe charges. So political strategist Roger Stone, a longtime ally of President Trump, has been arrested in Florida, charged with 7 counts in the Mueller probe. Mr. Stone will appear in court later in the city of Fort Lauderdale. The indictment includes 1 count of obstruction of an official proceeding, 5 counts of false statements, and 1 count of witness tampering. The charges are linked to an alleged Russian-led hack into the emails of Democratic Party officials. So the information contained in the emails are released by WikiLeaks, or was released by WikiLeaks, during the 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign. CNN reported that FBI agents arrested Mr. Stone in a pre-dawn raid on Friday, today. One pounded on the door and said, "FBI, open the door," the U.S. outlet says. Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign chairman, John Podesta, targeted in the email hack, accused Mr. Stone of knowing about it beforehand. According to investigators, Mr. Stone said he had communicated with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange before the email's release and had described the contact as perfectly legal. The indictment accuses the lobbyist of lying to the House Intelligence Committee about what passed between him and WikiLeaks and of falsely claiming not to have records of it. Mr. Stone is said to have spoken to senior Trump campaign officials who are not identified about Organization One, which is believed to be WikiLeaks, and information it might have had that would be damaging to the Clinton campaign. So prosecutors say that Mr. Stone was also contacted by senior Trump campaign officials to inquire about future releases by WikiLeaks. His campaign activities have long been under scrutiny by special counsel Robert Mueller, who is investigating allegations of collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. In 2016, the U.S. intelligence agencies concluded that Russia had tried to turn the election in Mr. Trump's favor through a state-authorized relay of cyber attacks and fake news stories planted on social media. Mr. Trump has branded the Mueller inquiry a political witch hunt, quote unquote, and the Kremlin has always denied meddling in the U.S. election. Mr. Stone has repeatedly said in interviews that he expected to be indicted. In May, he told NBC's Meet the Press, it is not inconceivable now that Mr. Mueller and his team may seek to conjure up some extraneous crime pertaining to my business, or maybe not even pertaining to the 2016 election. I would chalk this up to an effort, to silence me. That's the president talking. And then a press notice came out only maybe in the last hour that simply said, whatever is taking place with Mr. Stone is unrelated to anything that the president did before or after he became president. Well, there's evidently a missing link. So through past indictments, John Mueller has been building the case that Russians were behind the hacking of senior Democratic and Hillary Clinton campaign officials. He alleges that they then used WikiLeaks to inject damaging information they garnered into the United States political bloodstream at a time most harmful to Democrats. What the special counsel's office had yet to allege is that there were any ties between WikiLeaks and the Trump presidential campaign. So today, Mr. Mueller charged longtime Trump advisor and confidant Roger Stone with being that missing link, citing communications between Mr. Stone and senior Trump campaign officials before and after the WikiLeaks documents were released. The move marks a significant development in this nearly two-year legal drama. For the first time, a member of Mr. Trump's inner circle, albeit an informal one, is facing charges directly related to Russian election meddling, the central thrust of the special counsel's investigation. Mr. Stone has denied suggestions of criminal misconduct. The man who has boasted of being a master of the political dark arts and who seemed to crave the notoriety that went along with such claims now finds himself directly in the center of a withering legal spotlight. Who is in charge, or who's been in charge in the Mueller probe? Mr. Stone is the 34th person to be charged as part of the Mueller investigation, and those indicted include 12 Russian military officials, officers particularly, and 13 Russian nationals accused of leading a campaign to interfere in the U.S. election. Another three Russian entities, including the notorious Internet Research Agency, it's a troll farm, have also been charged. Several people connected directly with Mr. Trump have been indicted, including the former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort, the former chairman of his election campaign, who is in jail. So a longtime friend of Donald Trump, Roger Stone, has worked on Republican political campaigns since the 1970s. The 60-year-old favors three-piece suits and reportedly refuses to wear socks. Began his career working on Richard Nixon's 1972 reelection bid and has a tattoo of the 37th president across his shoulder blades in the back. And Mr. Stone published a book, The Making of the President, 2016, after helping Mr. Trump come to power. So these are going to be very, very interesting situations that are going to make a big impact on how things transpire as we move forward. It's going to be very, very compelling. So let's just quickly look. Bear with me one second. I want to move on to some other issues that you may find pertinent. Bear with me a second. And this is what's going on now in the stalemate of opening the government. Evidently, Trump is demanding a down payment on the wall as a shutdown impasse continues. So U.S. senators made a new try to ending a partial month-long government shutdown through a temporary funding bill on Thursday, but President Donald Trump demanded a down payment for a border wall that Democrats reject. So after the Republican-led Senate failed to advance two measures to reopen shuttered agencies, Democrats and Republican lawmakers spoke on the Senate floor and urged quick passage of a three-week stopgap funding bill to create time for talks on border security. White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders said such a measure would only work, quote, if there is a large down payment on the wall, end quote. But a spokesman for Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Democrats had made clear to the Republicans that, quote, they will not support funding for the wall, end quote. Now, Trump, who sparked as a shutdown now in its 34th day with his demand for $5.7 billion in funding for the U.S.-Mexico border wall, told reporters that the votes in after the votes in the Senate, quote, we have no choice but to have a wall or a barrier, and if we don't have that, it's just not going to work, referring to border security. Trump said that if Schumer and Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell come to a reasonable agreement to end the party, the partial government shutdown, I would support it, he says. And McConnell said that late on Thursday, the talks were ongoing. At least we're talking. I think that's better than it was before, he said. And Democratic House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that Trump's demand for a large down payment on a border wall, quote, is not a reasonable agreement, end quote. The shutdown has left 800,000 federal workers without pay and struggling to make ends meet as the effects on government services and the economy reverberate nationwide. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said he had spoken to Trump about a short-term funding bill. Quote, all of us believe if we have 3 weeks with the government open that we could find a way forward, produce a bill that we would sign that would be good for everybody in the country, Graham said on the Senate floor. Quote, to my Democratic friends, money for a barrier is required to get this deal done, end quote. Earlier, a bill backed by Trump to end the shutdown by funding the wall and a separate bill supported by Democrats to reopen shuttered agencies without such funding did not get the votes required to advance in the 100-member chamber. So Trump has touted Republican unity during the longest shutdown in U.S. history, but in a sign of cracks in that resolve or just a desire for compromise, six Republican senators voted with Democrats on their measure to reopen government agencies temporarily without money for a wall. They included freshman Senator Mitt Romney, the Republican Party's 2012 presidential nominee. Quote, Democrats have said they're not willing to negotiate unless the government's open. Well, they tried their effort. I voted for it. It didn't happen. Now they've got to renegotiate or to negotiate, Romney said. Pelosi told reporters earlier she was willing to meet with Trump to discuss the shutdown. Her comments came one day after she essentially withdrew an invitation for Trump to give his State of the Union in the House chamber next Tuesday, saying that would not happen until the shutdown ended. Trump, who had planned to come despite the shutdown and considered giving the speech at another venue, conceded late on Wednesday and said he would deliver that speech in the House in the near future. U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross on Thursday urged furloughed federal workers to seek loans to pay their bills while adding in a CNBC interview that he could not understand why they were having trouble getting by. Well, so Pelosi denounced the comments, is this the let-him-eat-cake kind of attitude or call your father for money or this is character building for you, Pelosi asked at a news conference. She said she did not understand or why Ross would make the comment, quote, as hundreds of thousands of men and women are about to miss a second paycheck tomorrow, Pelosi without mentioning Ross. Nancy has just said that said she just doesn't understand why. Very simply, without a wall, it all doesn't work. Our country has a chance to greatly reduce crime, human trafficking, gangs, and drugs. Should have been done for decades. We will not cave. he said in a tweet. A Reuters Ipsos poll last week found more than half of Americans blame Trump for the shutdown, even as he has sought to shift blame to Democrats after saying last month he would be proud, quote unquote, to close the government for border security. Very, very hard to say where all of this lies. That is for sure. Now, this is also very interesting with respect to the president. So there is a danger lying in Trump's newfound zeal for overseas democracy. Every now and then, the U.S. establishment gives Donald Trump a surprise ovation. And Mr. Trump's missile attack on Syria's regime in early of 2017 was the first such instance. One second. His all-measure short of war declaration against Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro on Wednesday is the latest. Each showed Mr. Trump is capable of adopting a traditional U.S. foreign policy stance. In Syria's case, Mr. Trump acted in the name of human rights after President Bashar al-Assad chemical weapons on his own people. With Venezuela, Mr. Trump is backing the rule of law against Mr. Maduro's rigged re-election. Thank you, Mr. President, tweeted Jeb Bush. The danger lies in Mr. Trump's follow-up. Almost 2 years since the U.S. launched Tomahawk missiles at Syria, Mr. Assad is more firmly entrenched than ever, and Mr. Trump is set to withdraw the United States' 2,000 remaining troops. He quickly lost patience with the Syria chess game. Venezuela poses a different problem. The danger of an open civil war between supporters of Juan Guaido, the opposition leader and self-declared interim president, and Mr. Maduro's armed forces are real. And Mr. Trump is now committed to Mr. Guaido's victory. Now, much hinges on whether Venezuela's armed forces can be persuaded to heed Mr. Trump's call to follow Mr. Guaido's order. If they are not, and the top brass is not, they're supporting the Venezuelan leader, Mr. Maduro could adopt an Assad-style posture of digging in and calling Mr. Trump's bluff, at which point he would be put to the test. In 2017, Mr. Trump said he would not rule out a military option if necessary against Mr. Maduro's regime. We have troops all over the world in places that are very, very far away, Mr. Trump said. Venezuela is not very far away, quote unquote. Some might call it Mr. Trump's Monroe Doctrine, by which the U.S. treats the Western Hemisphere as its exclusive backyard. But those cheering Mr. Trump's newfound zeal for overseas democracy should bear in mind three caveats. The first is that Mr. Trump is select. He has shown scant interest in speaking up for human rights or democracy in other parts of the world, such as Myanmar, Sudan, and China. Nor does the Monroe exception apply. Mr. Trump has been as oblivious to rigged elections and human rights abuse in Guatemala and Honduras in the Western Hemisphere as anywhere else. But why look a gift horse in the mouth is what people are asking. If Mr. Trump is selectively doing the right thing, it is surely better than never at all. So the problem is that it makes him even less predictable. Either those principles are universal or they are not. He has yet to explain on what basis he takes those decisions. So, which brings up the second caveat. Mr. Trump is heavily influenced by Cuban Americans and Venezuelan exiles in Florida. Many rub shoulders with him at his winter White House in Mar-a-Lago. And most of Venezuela's financial elites have fled the country, along with a tenth of its population. Many exiles bought condo units in Florida, Trump properties, in fact. It is impossible to draw a line between Mr. Trump's business ties and his support for democracy in Venezuela. But it is worth stressing that he has consistently spoken up for freedom in just three countries, Cuba, Iran, and Venezuela. For some reason, these are in a separate category to the rest of the world. the fact that refugees from Guatemala and Honduras tend to be poor, while the Venezuelans he meets in Florida are not, might have something to do with it. The third caveat is that Mr. Trump is in a brewing constitutional showdown of his own. While he was making his Venezuela statements on Wednesday, he was in a tense standoff with Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker, who is refusing to invite him to deliver the annual State of the Union address next week. Trump's government shutdown is now in its 34th day. It hinges on his ultimatum of funding a border wall to keep out refugees and migrants from some of America's decidedly undemocratic nearby neighbors. Mr. Trump's Venezuela gamble thus comes at an interesting moment. It puts him on the right side of Washington's foreign policy community and most of the world. The rest of the hemisphere, including Canada, promptly followed Mr. Trump's suit and almost word for word. Few doubt that Mr. Maduro is a pariah who deserves to be thrown out of power. The irony is, on any other day of the week, many would say the same of Mr. Trump. So very, very compelling perspective, I believe. And these are some of the issues that take place. Now let's move on to different parts of the world. Evidently, Greece's parliament today ratified an accord that changes the name of neighboring Macedonia, unblocking, after decades, the ex-Yugoslav republic's aspiration to join the European Union and NATO. A narrow majority of 153 ministers of parliament in the 300-seat chamber approved the deal, with several independent lawmakers supporting Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras' leftist Syriza party. The vote handed Tsipras a diplomatic triumph over an issue that has sparked protests across Greece. Quote, with this agreement, Greece regains its history, its symbols, its tradition, Tsipras told the chamber ahead of the vote during the two-day debate, calling an end to 30 years of hypocrisy. He stressed that Macedonia will henceforth become a friend, an ally, a supporter for cooperation, peace, and security in the area. Macedonia's parliament on January 11 backed a constitutional revision to change the name to the Republic of North Macedonia. But for the deal to go through, it had to be approved by the Greek ministers of parliament. The settlement ends a 20-year-old row between Athens and Skopje over the use of the term Macedonia by renaming the tiny Balkan state Republic of North Macedonia. The historic vote was initially scheduled for Thursday, but was postponed because around 230 lawmakers wanted to speak on the issue Friday. Trapped in history's shadow since 1991, Athens has objected to its neighbor being called Macedonia because Greece has a northern province of the same name. In ancient times, it was the cradle of Alexander the Great's empire, a source of intense pride for Greeks. Protests have been held in both countries against the agreement, some of them violent, and lawmakers in Greece have reported threats and arson attacks against their homes. A poll released by SKAI TV on Thursday night, found 62% of respondents opposed the deal, with 27% in favor. A week earlier, another poll in Prototema Weekly had found 66% in opposition. Well, Tsipras was closely involved in brokering the June deal with a Macedonian counterpart, Zoran Zaev. Both have staked their political careers on its outcome. Anti-Tsipras Daily Taneia on Friday said the deal was the result of a painful compromise, quote-unquote, and was full of pitfalls, quote-unquote. In addition to normalizing relations between the two countries, implementation of the agreement will open the door for Macedonia to joined the European Union and NATO, hitherto blocked. But in Greece, its neighbor's name continues to fuel controversy in politics and society ahead of parliamentary elections scheduled for October, which is going to put Tsipras under tremendous pressure. Critics say the agreement, which drops Greece's objection to an official Macedonian language and identity, opens the way for possible cultural usurpation and trade disputes. Main opposition leader Kyriakos Mitsotakis of the conservative New Democracy Party said that the agreement creates new problems and awakens nationalism. Your foreign policy is superficial and ignorant. You should be ashamed, he told the government. But Tsipras insisted on Thursday, we never had a Macedonian language. Alexander the Great spoke Greek. Are you afraid of a state that does not even have 2% of our military capability and not even 6% of our economic output? Former Foreign Minister Nikos Kotsias, a signatory of the agreement, asked Parliament on Thursday. Over the weekend, clashes between police and masked protesters left 40 people injured as tens of thousands demonstrated in Athens against the name change the government blamed far-right extremists and the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party for the violence. So it goes. These are the troubles of our times. Now, bear with me a second. I'm going to go back to our studio screen in a moment. Okay. And let's find out what they're doing over at the Cabot Creamery, and then we'll be back.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, welcome back. This is Westchester on the level. Well, it seems scores were killed in a Taliban attack on the Afghan security base. At least 65 people were killed in a Taliban-claimed attack on an Afghan intelligence base, security sources said on Tuesday, raising the toll substantially from 12 announced previously. The militants detonated a vehicle packed with explosives at the training facility before gunmen arrived in a car and opened fire. We took about 65 bodies out of the rubble yesterday, Mohammed Sadar Bakhyari had said. He's the deputy head of the provincial council in Vardak province, where the attack occurred on Monday in the latest blow to beleaguered security forces. A senior security official who spoke on condition of anonymity gave an even higher toll of at least 70 killed. On Monday, provincial officials told agents France Press that just 12 people had been killed in the attack. Figures given by officials to other media range from 12 dead to more than 100 killed. Mr. Bayakari's announcement came after nearly a day of confusion surrounding the toll. On Monday, provincial officials told agents France Press just 12 people had been killed in the attack. Figures given by officials to other media range from 12 to over 100. And the attack was on a training facility for the NDS, the Afghan Intelligence Agency, meaning that any toll will likely be difficult to confirm. It saw militants ram a Humvee filled with explosives into the National Directorate of Security, that's the NDS, based in Maidan Shar, the capital of Vardak, which lies about 50 kilometers south of Kabul. The attack caused the roof to partially collapse, images from the scene it shows. Then at least three other attackers in a Toyota car who were following the Humvee entered the compound. Vardak provincial council member Abdul Wahid Akbarzai told agents France Press on Tuesday. The attackers were killed quickly, he said, but most of the casualties were caused by the roof collapse. It is a big loss, council head Akhtar Mohammed Tahriri had said. The NDS forces are better trained and equipped than the Afghan police and army soldiers who've been dying in record numbers. He added the militants were dressed in uniforms used by Afghan special forces. The attack came comes a day after a Taliban suicide bomber targeted the convoy of Logar province's governor, killing at least 7 security guards. Fights between security guards and Taliban fighters have continued to intensify across the country during the freezing Afghan winter, which traditionally experiences a reduction in combat. So the recent skirmishes come as the Taliban announced a resumption of talks with U.S. officials in Qatar as the two sides discuss a possible peace treaty that could pave the way for the insurgents' participation in the next government. Washington has not confirmed their claim, but the talks are continuing. U.S. Special Peace Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has headed a flurry of diplomatic activity in recent months, seeking to bring the Taliban to the table for talks. However, the insurgents threatened to suspend the fledgling process last week. The Taliban, who have been waging a 17-year war against the Western-backed Afghan government, claimed responsibility for the assault. So, very, very interesting, of course, to say the least. Now, let's just find out a moment what else is going on. Bear with me a moment. And just give me a second here. All right, 1 second here. All right, 1 more minute here. I want you to just check to see what else we have here. All right, 1 more second. Yeah, this is very interesting because Turkish court has ordered the release of a Kurdish minister of parliament after 11 weeks on a hunger strike. So a Turkish court today ordered the supervised release of a detained lawmaker from the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, the HDP, who is seriously ill as a result of her 11-week hunger strike. Leyla Güven, 55, launched a hunger strike on November 8 in protest at the prison's conditions for Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan, and her deteriorating health has sparked concerns and allies to support her cause. The Minister of Parliament will be monitored after she is freed, the court in Diyarbakir in the Kurdish majority southeast said, although few further details of the terms of her release are yet available. Güven's party has said is suffering a life-threatening medical condition, did not attend the hearing, according to an Agence France-Presse journalist in the court. She was arrested in January of 2018 for her criticism of Turkey's military operation against the Syrian Kurdish militia that Ankara considers an offshoot of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. The Minister of Parliament started the hunger strike in prison, and her action was supported by more than 150 prisoners across Turkey in a show of solidarity. Güven's hunger strike was aimed at pressuring the government into allowing lawyers and family members to visit PKK leader Öcalan, who has been serving a life sentence on an island prison near Istanbul since his capture in 1999. Öcalan met his brother Mehmet for the first time in more than 2 years on January 12. The details of that meeting were not yet made public. In 2012, hundreds of Kurdish prisoners ended a 68-day hunger strike after Öcalan urged them to do so. Güven's HDP party remains under the scrutiny of Turkish authorities, which accuse it of links to the PKK. And several of its ministers of parliament are behind bars, including former party leader Selahattin Demirtas. So, my God, that's where things are going, and it's going to be very interesting to see what else is happening. We move on to the next stage. Bear with me a moment. Got to get all these things up and running, as they say. One moment. Okay, 1 second. All right, 1 more moment. I've got it. I guess I misplaced it. Bear with me a moment. Let's just see here. All right. I think maybe I just misplaced it. I'm going to look one more second. Bear with me. And we'll see if it's here. If it's not, then it just isn't. Okay. Where is it? All right, I'm going to take one last shot and see if it's there. Yeah, this is part of the issue. This is a report that came in with regard to the crisis in Venezuela. Bear with me a moment as I try to play this for you. Okay, bear with me a second here. All right, let's see if we can get this started. Bear with me a moment here. All right, we should get started shortly.
He told me I had to take one item out of all the baby gear he might have. I'd downgrade my stroller and take the snip.
All right, let's see.
Protests and in previous years by Venezuelans and being repressed by the same military which controls the economy, that the same military which is violating human rights and controlling protests from escalating in Caracas and nationwide.
All right, well, that was
the economy, that the same military which is violating human rights and controlling protests from escalating in Caracas and nationwide.
But that was Diego Moya Ocampos. He's an American senior analyst at IHS Country Risk. And evidently, though, but somehow or another, the entire video did not play. But evidently, those are some of the issues there. One thing that is compelling, too, is that Turkey, Iran, and Russia are backing the Maduro government. And it's interesting that it's those three. So can you imagine Russia, Turkey, and Iran backing up what's going on in Venezuela. So I don't know which way one people think is appropriate, but it's compelling, that's for sure. All right, well, I guess that's about it. I don't see anything more here. Let me just quickly check if there's anything new that came up in with regard to new business. No, that's it. I think we're done. So that's our story today. Thanks very much for being with us. It's most appreciated. And what we'll do is we'll be speaking to you on Monday. There'll be a lot to talk about, especially being in on the other side of a gun, you know, by the Mueller investigation. So it's going to be very interesting to see where we go with it. So that's the story. And that's it. So take care. And then I'm going to just try to see. I think we may have gotten rid of one of our pages. So bear with me a moment. And we'll see if we can get to that. All right, so we are here, and then we'll say goodbye. Take care, and thanks again for being with us. Bye.